Here at Renew Energy Partners, climate change is very important to us, and so is beer. In every episode of the Green Beers podcast, we taste a beer together. We talk about the brewery and their sustainability practices. And then we talk about a topic relating to our work in decarbonizing buildings and mitigating climate change.
Welcome to Green Beers. My name is Mike Savage, and I'm here with
Charlie Lauren,
Nathan Montgomery.
And today our special guests are from EnergyRM.
Hi, I'm
Jason Gregory.
Hey, this is Ashish Vatsal.
Thank you both for joining us. Today, we're going to be talking about EnergyRM, both of your backgrounds, and a special beer, Fat Tire, the high-quality, low-impact.
So we're opening our beers. Jason and Ashish, welcome. We are very proud to be partnered with you, and it's great to have you on the podcast to talk more about your backgrounds, your work, and how we work together. As we pour our beers, I'll note that before we started, we considered whether we should transition to a video version of Green Beers, but Ashish confirmed that we have faces for radio. So you'll all be glad to know we're sticking with the podcast format.
we got the voices for radio.
There you go.
That's what I meant.
Let's get right into it. So, Jason or Ashish, who wants to tell us, you know, the secret to world peace? Let's get into
beer.
Absolutely.
That's called a bait switch.
Yeah. Oh, my bad. Jason, your background, you want to start there. What led you to start EnergyRM?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. Thanks for having us. We're excited to be on the podcast. My background, after undergraduate, I landed at a consulting firm that ended up within the first year of me being there, deciding that it was going to specialize in utilities. And to a lesser extent, oil and gas. And so I spent the next probably about 8 years learning what it meant to advise investor-owned utility companies on business transformation and operations. Got to do some really interesting projects with a lot of great companies, and also got to do some interesting things with in the oil and gas sector, like Chevron and their global supply and trading function. I got to wear steel-toe boots at one point and walk a West Texas pipeline, and got to see both the regulated and less regulated sides of the energy market.
So, Jason, do you camp out night after night, or how does that work when you walk a pipeline?
Yeah. No, you stay in a roadside hotel, don't earn points. It's not what you might think. But moved from there. I went to work for a software startup. It just raised their Series C round of financing that was building and selling software to utility companies to help manage energy efficiency programs and engage with their customers, which was important mission-driven work for me. That also taught me how painful it is at times to work with utility companies and regulators around energy efficiency. And how, as a kind of a personal belief, we should be using capital markets to drive decarbonization in buildings, and not rely on utility ratepayer buy downs, the cost of projects, as the exclusive catalyst for decarbonization.
So, side
which
note,
really led into EnergyRM.
Yes, and just before you jump into that side note, Jason, it's interesting because you and I have never talked about that, but when Steve Pritchard, my co-founder, and I had lunch with our third co-founder, Doug Foy, that was the exact insight he had. He had been advising cities on decarbonization, trying to do it with utility incentives, and said, it's not working. So anyway, similar insights.
Yeah.
Private money.
I think depending on the utility and the jurisdiction, you have leaders of these very large businesses who in some cases want to help decarbonize, and others who maybe don't as much. Either way, the path to doing that and the path to using utilities as the lever is through a regulator, which is a slow-moving, in some cases litigious, and not the business that I wanted to be in myself. So that left Energy RM. So maybe Ashish, you want to, I can pass to you, share your background, and then I can talk about how we got to where we are with Energy RM.
Absolutely.
Happy to. Hey, everyone. So my background, I jokingly say I'm on my third career now. My first one after college, I have a comp sci undergrad degree, which I have never used professionally, but it did come in handy in my first career, which was on Wall Street. I was at Morgan Stanley briefly after college and then joined a small hedge fund. I was in New York working for a hedge fund as an analyst, managing a portfolio of investments for 4 years from 2005 to 2009. So I got a front row seat to that last global recession and saw things that, you know, most people didn't get to see and what was happening in the global capital markets. Learned a ton
the scary
about investment.
The rest of us never
was
happening, right?
yeah, for sure. There are definitely some moments there where, I thought the entire global financial system was collapsing. I learned a ton about risk management, investment allocation, making trades and making investments. But really got a really inside view into the power of capitalism for good and for bad. So that was my first career. I always knew I wanted to go back to grad school, so I did. Went to the University of Michigan, Ross School of Business, got my MBA, which then led to my second career in consulting. I was a management consultant for 11 years, first at the Boston Consulting Group, then at a smaller project implementation management firm, and then started my own consulting practice around COVID times. A large part of that was wanting to have more control over the work that I wanted to do, the clients I wanted to work with. But along the way, I had picked up a lot of skills about what it takes to get things done within organizations, how to develop solutions, how to gather a bunch of data, perform the analysis, get stakeholders lined up and behind an initiative, and not just create academic solutions that gather dust on a shelf, but actually lead those multi-year projects myself within organizations, lead teams and get that and impact that we were all going for. When I was with my own independent consulting firm, I ran into Jason. We were actually introduced by a mutual contact, Charlie, similar to you and I, also a Yale alum. So mm-hmm. The Yale connection runs strong in this group.
Excellent.
He connected me with Jason, and then we got to talking, and I found the model that they were building here fascinating, which led to my third career, combining capitalism, combining consulting, combining business development backgrounds into where we are now at Energy RM, and couldn't be happier to be here.
That's great. Well, that tees up perfectly. More about Energy RM, and, you know, spoiler alert, we are in a very exciting partnership with Energy RM that I'm sure we'll talk about, but would love to hear more about, you know, we'll make sure that the podcast listeners know how, you know, what your mission is and how you do what you do and the problem you're solving, because it's certainly something that we're excited about.
Yeah. Yeah. So, Jason, what was the original thesis and what was the original problem that you saw in the market that you were trying to solve?
Yeah, it's always interesting to kind of look at the original thesis and then look at where we are now. Because I think for most startups that have made it through the earliest stages, those two things are never the same or rarely the same.
Right.
We initially went to market with a component of our current software platform. Where we issued patents, but it's a virtual metering technology for determining the energy efficiency output of a project in a way that really satisfies the risk requirements of capital market investors, but does so at high speed and low cost. So we call this capability the Delta Meter. And we thought that we could build a business around that capability. I think what we've learned over time is that really is a feature of our current product, which is a transaction platform, as opposed to the product itself. We looked at the commercial real estate market predominantly, and also at project and infrastructure investors, and said, why are commercial buildings some of the worst performing from an energy perspective of all of the building stock? What are these economic misalignments that exist that have caused this to be true? And what can we as a transaction platform company, what can we do about it? And what we concluded is that we could facilitate the flow of project capital from partners like Renew to fund comprehensive energy retrofits of buildings, not just in commercial, but in other sectors as well, and do so in a way that aligned economic interests between capitalist investors, saying that in a very positive sense, because they can do good work, and that of the real estate owners and the asset management and building valuation imperatives that they have. And so that led us to this transaction platform. So we facilitate a long-term energy transaction that gives building owners a paid-for energy retrofit without encumbrance and without performance risk. And then on the other side of the transaction are firms like Renew, who earn returns on these energy retrofits as a market-based asset. So I could talk forever on it, but I'll kind of...
Well, I was going to say, fair warning to the podcast listeners, we're about to geek out on this stuff, but let me frame how important it is. In most cities, commercial real estate is 70 to 80% of the carbon footprint of a city. Renew, for our part, had tried three different, essentially, campaigns, if you will, to get into commercial real estate and or REITs, real estate investment trusts. It's an obvious way to put money to work in a large portfolio, and it's a central piece of decarbonizing if we're going to hit our 2030 and 2015 numbers in the U.S. And all three times that we mounted these campaigns, we ran into the same problem, which is commercial real estate owners typically hold the real estate for 3 to 5 years. They don't want any additional friction in that potential sale. They're not long-term hold owners like the owner-occupied groups. Our manufacturing customers own a factory. They intend to own it for the foreseeable future. That's not the case here. And the transaction has to be seamless to them. It has to not scare the owner that that it will make it hard to sell, right? That's one issue. There were also additional issues around, what happens in the case of either a transaction or a bankruptcy of a specific building, because in commercial real estate, you're usually signing the contract with an individual building. It might be owned by a very deeply well-resourced holding company, but you've got to get your investment committee and your lenders to look at a single building. And the question becomes, what happens if that building changes ownership through the bank? There'll still be people using it. They'll still be using your efficiency retrofits, but boy, that gets complicated. So, we just went sort of right to the heart of the matter, but, at a general level, that's not insignificant. Basically, there are roadblocks to providing third-party funding for big chunks of the real estate in this country. We had run into those roadblocks repeatedly in trying to get this building sector to do the efficiency retrofits that were available to them, and we couldn't get it done. And, essentially enter Energy RM, who has developed this platform to solve those two big problems and some of the others as well.
Yeah, yeah. And these are not small problems, right? I mean, 70% of the building, 70-80% is that's the carbon in a city, but also 70% is about roughly the ownership of buildings by investors. So third parties are the ones who are responsible for carbon. And so how do we build a program that is going to allow them to do what they want to do, which is eventually sell this property, but also meet them, the demands of regulators, customers, tenants.
Right.
Everybody wants these buildings to use less, but at the same time, they're looking at it from a fiduciary. And they're just like, well,
right.
Why, right? And now this model is unique and it allows them to do that, right? And that's why we're very excited about it.
Yeah.
Yeah, we boil it down to three core challenges that building owners face that cause them to not invest in decarbonizing their assets. And Mike, as you talked about, these are very foundational considerations, especially as a fiduciary, as an investment manager. The first is that I think it's the number is something like 60 or 65% of commercial real estate are leased to tenants under a net lease where tenants pay for the cost of energy.
Right.
So the first problem is that when that's true, the owner earns a negative IRR, negative return on any kind of investment in efficiency or renewables. The second is the hold period visibility that you alluded to, where if you're going to sell the building, we're only have visibility into how long you'll own the building for the next 1, 2, maybe 3 years. You're not going to justify anything other than maybe LED light bulbs. You're not going to do the heavy lift around the central plant, the big energy consuming things. And the third reason that we're seeing more and more in the current interest rate environment is just CapEx availability. Or to the extent that owners are spending capital dollars, it's on things that are highly visible to tenants or future tenants, like lobbies and elevators. So how can we take that reality, those three realities for building owners, and turn it into a scenario that only benefits them? They get the capital improvements, the decarbonization, the new equipment without needing to assume an encumbrance and without needing to take on the performance risk. So enter Renew, right, who has a large sum of project capital available for building owners who want to do just that.
Yep. I mentioned my my first career was in capital markets, right? It was on Wall Street. And so an analogy that I use that helps me understand and helps me explain the unlock that we have here is, if you go back several years and on Wall Street, you could invest in stocks and bonds. There was no such thing as options, because options hadn't been invented yet. Because how do you price the price of a stock option to call, a call option to buy stock in, I don't know, NVIDIA 6 months from now based on the past volatility, where it is now and where you want to strike it? And how do you price that? You couldn't have an investment grade pricing for that. And so the option market didn't exist. No one could agree on that. Until in 1973, the Black-Scholes model, or the Black-Scholes-Merton model, if you want to be really nerdy about it, came about and figured out the formula for how to price options. And then they went on to win the Nobel Prize. And suddenly that was a big unlock, and the options market was born, and it's huge. And for us, the unlock has been bringing in the capital that allows all these benefits to the building owners without them having to put up their own capital and take on the risks of the project performance.
Nobody's claiming that the ESA will, the Energy RM transaction platform will win a Nobel Prize, but you never know.
No one's saying they won't.
Yeah, right, exactly. Well said, Ashish.
It is up there now.
I mean, let's face it, it's an important problem. It's a, you know, I think that's a great analogy, right? It's about, and that's what we're trying to do together, is unlock energy efficiency and decarbonization projects. And Mike alluded to this, but I know from our conversations that you're seeing significant market pressures on the owners of these assets to do something about carbon. I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about that, because that's working in our favor, right? It's not as if this can be ducked for much longer. Something has to be done, and the idea is that we're offering collectively a solution that helps them do that.
Yeah, I think that's true. I want to highlight, though, that this kind of project funding can solve more than decarbonization. Decarbonization might be the goal or the kind of the end state that we as Energy RM and maybe you as Renew, but I don't want to put words in your mouth, are working towards, because we believe it's important for, yes, for the earth. But I also believe that this type of project funding meets a very core need of real estate asset owners, just around CapEx availability, asset refresh, and making them more desirable, easier to maintain for their tenants. And so we approach it from that perspective. You'll actually note that decarbonization, I don't think, is stated on our website anywhere. This is really all about a CapEx funding strategy.
That's fascinating. And, you know, it's certainly consistent with our view, which is that there are multiple benefits to portfolios of doing these projects, from resilience to building comfort to cost savings. We do lead with decarbonization. It's just in our DNA. But as you said, it's not an either or. It's a both and.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Yeah.
I mean, I think to me, it's a conversation that is just, it's interesting around decarb versus deferred maintenance, or how do you want to describe the pain points? But at the end of the day, it's Jason and Ashish, you know, we're just really excited to have this partnership and to bring this to market. What are you seeing as sort of like the next, you know, we were asking this question a little bit more at the beginning of the year, but now as we roll into March, like, well, what are you seeing as the future in the space when it comes to, you know, supporting these real estate organizations and helping them, you know, address this capital challenge, decarb challenge, however you want to describe it, but right, it's asset renewal. Where do you see the future of the industry going?
I think the way, it's a really good question. So I think the way of the future is going to be, I'll just say, comprehensive. I think real estate owners are used to looking at incremental improvement, light bulbs, or replacing one single piece of equipment when it breaks, or you know, doing things that are pieces and parts. And I think the way of the future is to look at a building in its entirety, including maybe the adjacent land that you could develop for ground mount solar, and seeing how can we bring a fundamental change to the energy performance of a building and create value for everybody, meaning the owner of the building, the project investor who's putting their capital at risk, and other parties in this ecosystem. Such that the projects that we're seeing are increasing in their investments per square foot as opposed to decreasing. Even though we have inflationary pressure, we have interest rates that are high. I guess when you look at it on a long scale, they're not as high as maybe they have been on average over the last 20 years. But that comprehensive view allows us to think about buildings as a source of value creation through decarbonization.
Agreed.
We're seeing projects that are, I'm just going to maybe say, projects that include boilers and chillers and rooftop solar and EV charging and, I think we'll be able to increasingly put all that together to maximize the impact and the value output.
Yeah, I would wholeheartedly agree with that. I love the moment. You're familiar with the picture where, you know, you have this image and sometimes it's a duck, but if you look at it the other way, it's a bunny, the duck bunny image. I love those moments where we can have the mind flip moment with building owners where, you know, if they're used to thinking, well, if it's a bigger project, it's going to have a worse ROI, it's going to have negative financial impact. But in fact, the bigger the project, and if it includes on-site generation, they tend to actually do better in a lot of cases.
It's right? A bunny.
So those, it's a bunny. It was a duck, but now it's a bunny.
Right.
And that moment where they go, oh, so it doesn't have to be just LED lighting and low-hanging fruit. It doesn't have to be just a $50,000 project. It can be a $10, $15, $20 million project. And it works.
Right.
Whoa. Okay.
That's
really cool.
That's incredible. And that's a consistent theme for us, is getting both our design build partners who are used to trying to show their customers just enough for them to say yes to. And the customers similarly will internally, you know, the head of facilities or even the head of sustainability will say, I need just enough that I can get through the capital budget. It's a complete paradigm shift to say, no, actually, Renew wants to fund more. Let's get as big as we can. You know, it's a bunny.
Right. It's
a bunny. We're going to have to incorporate that into our sales pitch.
It's a bunny.
It's a bunny. No, I love that. It's a big, we're talking about a paradigm shift about what's possible. And then, of course, as you point out, it has all these ancillary benefits if you do all of this at once and comprehensively, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So I think there's one more. What's going to happen is that the industry, I'll just kind of use that very vaguely, but is used to seeing, of course, utility-delivered energy as energy, and it has ongoing value. They're used to seeing renewables, you know, solar panels on the roof or wind generation as something that has ongoing value. But I don't think the industry is used to looking at energy efficiency as something that has ongoing value. And it does, right? If you look at through the utility paradigm of we incentivize using ratepayer dollars, you know, to buy down the cost of light bulbs, that's kind of a thing. But when we think about a major investment in a building that includes energy efficiency and renewables and other things, all of this investment is producing energy value to meet the energy requirement of the building as it increases, as more and more of the world electrifies. So I think that's we're kind of getting abstract here, or I am at least. But I think that's a paradigm shift that's coming.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I think, we need one at the end of the day, right? What works, right? This system that we have of just power is produced here, it gets supplied there, it's old, right? All these were produced, 150 coming on, late 1800s, and then we've really just gone down the same path since. So hopefully we can start using less and do it in this novel way. I'm very excited about it. But I'm also excited about this beer we're drinking. And I can't, host Green Beers without talking about Fat Tire and our Green Beers podcast. So a few personal questions as we transition into the next segment here.
I like how you waited until the beer kicked in just a little bit to switch to the personal question. So I'm a little afraid for what's going to
happen. Exactly. We like to wait until you've had, this is related to something that Mike's wife, Leah, said about long podcasts. She said, you really need to shorten them up because they really start to ramble towards the end. But yes, we've loosened you up so we can get to the true Ashish.
Absolutely. So, first easy one, first beer.
First beer you ever had.
First beer. I don't think I could remember it, but probably something I drank from a keg back in college at a party.
Maybe at Feb
and
Club.
I distinctly remember. At Feb Club, yeah. Definitely was not Maury's. Yeah, got right. The first one. I do remember not liking it at all. Because, who likes their first sip of cheap college beer? And I just thought, I can't believe people drink this. Who's ever going to drink this again? And here we are, trying it again. My second beer ever.
How about you, Jeff?
I'm not going to say how old I was, but I think my first beer was a Heineken, which was not a great experience. Probably similar to yours, Ashish, where it's like, this is not what I expected this to be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That tracks. I think nobody, everyone is that we've talked to is always not telling the real age.
Right.
And did not enjoy it. I think that's a common thread.
It's a common thread.
Yeah.
How about How about favorite beer?
Ooh.
I've been liking the Crux IPA. I mean, Ashish and I are both in the Northwest, Pacific Northwest, where we have a lot of breweries, a lot of really great producers, and we also like our hoppy beer. So I like hoppy beer. The Crux IPA is
Crux the name of the brewery?
Yes.
Yeah, and it's in Seattle or in Portland. Sorry.
I don't actually know this for sure, but I believe it's in Oregon, but not in Portland.
Somewhere in Oregon. Awesome. All right, we may have to try that someday. How about you, Ashish?
I thought Crux was a Bend-based brewery.
I think that's right.
I have, yeah, I've had some good beers in Belgium that were amazing. But I would say one that just sticks out at me is something that I used to drink when I was in New York, when I lived in New York, and I have not found it very much on the West Coast, is by Magic Hat Brewery Company. Hat number 9.
Number 9 from South Burlington, Vermont. Absolutely.
So you know, Mike's a Vermont guy. So you're
oh yeah,
you're preaching to the choir on that one.
Yeah, yeah.
That is a good
choir here.
Yeah.
It's a great beer. I really liked it. And then I couldn't find it here in the Pacific Northwest where we're based until, surprisingly, I found it in sort of the polar opposite part of the U.S. up in the San Juan Islands in the Northwest. There was a brewery that had it in can bottles, and I was extremely surprised to find it there. And turns out you can order it online, so I have a couple sitting in my basement now.
Fantastic. That's actually not a brewery we've tried, but maybe worth doing.
Yeah. Yeah, Magic. I love Magic Hat. It was his Magic Hat, same town that I went to high school in. So,
yeah, did not, of course.
I'll try it in high school.
No, of course not.
But it was right across from the train tracks, and my buddy lived behind the train tracks. Yeah, it was great place. Waited to go to,
of course. And I now, Mike, now that I've said something that you like, I noticed in one of the last podcasts you were hating on Athletic Brewing.
Yes, indeed.
The non-alcoholic.
In fact, there's an ongoing debate on the podcast about whether it's beer at all, according to Mike. But
sure.
Yeah.
Sure. And I will say I really enjoy Athletic, and I will also say it is based out of my hometown, Milford, Connecticut. So I have a lot of pride in Athletic, and I will just say I'm a fan of Athletic, Mike. We can go head to head on this.
No, I mean I think it's some great.
Thank you, Ashish. I'm in your corner on this one.
It's a great drink. you know, it's a great tea. But like, you know, like what's?
But it's not your cup of tea. I get it.
No, it's just like it's all the worst part of a beer.
I'm a huge Athletic fan. Yes, the debate continues.
I mean, to each their own. It's a drink. We'll debate that one later.
We'll continue to debate.
Yes,
apparently.
Yeah. Now to our standard question, to our growing beer garden. If you could have one beer with anybody, living or historical, who would it be?
You know, I knew you were going to ask this question, but I didn't have a good one prepped. Yeah, she's sure about to give an answer.
I'll go, yeah. I don't know, this is going to sound cheesy, but I would love to have a great beer with my grandfathers or my grandparents, because I, you know, didn't get to know them very well. And just to know the history of my family and some of the stories and what they thought about when they were raising my parents, I think it would be some really fascinating stories.
So
to have the roots, to draw on those roots. I would love that.
That's great. So we welcome your grandparents to the beer garden. Where did they live and how well did you know them?
Yeah, my grandmothers are still alive and my grandfathers have passed away. Everyone was in India. I was born in India. I don't know if you've talked about that. I lived in there for the first 10 years. On my mother's side, it was in New Delhi. On my father's side, it was a little bit farther north in a smaller town. Yeah, so that's where they're from. They're from India, and my grandmothers are still living there.
Great. So we welcome your grandfathers into the beer garden. Yeah. And you're not the first person to choose a family member, actually. That's wonderful.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So Jason, who you got?
Yeah, and it can be living or not living.
Correct.
The one that came to mind, and this is not as maybe interesting as a grandparent, or maybe not the right answer, but I've been reading a lot about Michael Jordan and his relentless drive to win and the discipline that he had throughout his career, and how that it inspired, maybe even more than inspired, but required those around him to come to his level. I would love to have a beer with him and just kind of understand more about what makes somebody like that, who's so excellent at what they did, and we're seemingly so self-motivated. What makes them tick?
That's cool.
I'm not
First of all, there's no wrong answers to this question, but I will say that we have a Tiger Woods. So we have had athletes, great athletes before. So it's a, you know, I was just thinking we've asked this question enough. It's quite amazing that we've never had the same answer twice.
Yeah.
But we are starting to see some themes.
Yeah, we've got
Musicians, athletes, family members,
Greek.
Yeah.
Well, we've got one Greek mythological figure.
Who have you brought into the garden?
Who's what's that?
The two of you.
Oh, I said Rachel Carson.
I did Brady.
Brady. We have a bunch of great athletes.
Yeah, I think Brady.
They're all the goats.
Yeah. I think last week I went last time John Prine. I definitely think he'd be a good hang.
Right. But we need music. And then we have Nina Simone from Nathan.
Yeah, didn't you say Obama as well? Obama was on that list too.
Mike gets four people.
Yeah, Mike gets three people, and we all get one.
Well, we're gonna do an end of the year wrap up podcast where we're gonna go through the whole beer garden, which will be fun. It'll be great to see who's there. Cool. So we've got to wrap this up. This has been really fun, you guys. Nathan, can you tell us a little bit about the sustainability initiatives at New Belgium, and then we'll do our scoring?
Absolutely. Just reminding everybody, we're drinking Fat Tire Ale by a New Belgium brewery in Fort Collins, Colorado, a beautiful town, a front range of the Rocky Mountains. Lots of sustainability initiatives to run through. I'll start. Ashish, you mentioned enjoying Belgian beer, which is New Belgium, right? It's a classic U.S. thing. New York, New Amsterdam, New England, New Belgium. So it's a couple that started it did a bike trip through Belgium, and were inspired to bring those beer flavors to the U.S. and of course specifically Colorado. So one thing they talk about when in their sustainability initiatives is all the cycling that they support. They've distributed over 9 million to bicycle advocacy nonprofits across the nation, ranked number one in Bicycling Magazine's inaugural list of 25 best companies for cyclists. And they helped the city of Fort Collins become one of five platinum level bicycle friendly communities. So that's an intro goes along with how they founded the brewery. And of course they do have this focus on cycling. But in addition to that, they were actually the first brewery to implement wind power in 1998. So this is not a new focus of sustainability. They also have a 296 kilowatts of solar on their property, and they also make electricity at their water treatment plant, where they clean water before discharging it to the city treatment system, and it produces 11% of the electricity in the town of Fort Collins. There are so many things.
Well, I think the one to sort of captures the whole ethos of, around of sustainability is that Fat Tire is America's first certified carbon neutral beer. And the brewery is aiming for carbon neutrality by 2030.
Yes.
And they have set science-based climate targets. And it's interesting because we have done tasting. We've tasted beers where there's almost nothing on the website about this. And then this one, I think, Nathan, it'd be fair to say this one.
You could write a novelita.
Yeah, it's very, certainly in terms of sustainability, very extensive. And yeah, that was definitely going to end with that science-based target of carbon neutral by 2030.
Yeah. And you know, when they don't mention it at all, you wonder sort of how much, because there's sort of consistent themes. A lot of them do water treatment. A lot of them use the waste grain for digesters or other things. But you know, the fact that a brewery has set that goal means anybody could do it, right?
Exactly.
Right. One of the things that I really appreciated, I happen to have, I'm holding in my hand both the bottle and the can version of the beer. I've only opened the can. because I happen to have the bottle, and I was used to Fat Tire being in the bottles. I don't know why I've only seen them in bottles. And so I went down this rabbit hole of, oh, which one's more sustainable? Is it the aluminum can or the glass bottle? And I really appreciated they had a very thoughtful response on their website about what drives sustainability between bottles and cans. And I was surprised to hear the answer. They think it's more or less a draw. Other sources have said cans have the edge, depends on how much they're being recycled. But nevertheless, the answer on their website was very thoughtful.
That's really interesting.
And speaking of their can, I mean, this one, you read on, it says high quality, low impact, says alternatively powered, says it's carbon neutral. It's got the brood to protect the only planet we have. I mean, like, it's just a whole...
It's front and center.
Yeah, I mean...
We appreciate that. Luckily,
they also... Weren't they also a B Corp?
Are they?
I believe so, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, so I think, well, I'm not going to pre-assume the scoring, but
yeah,
suffice it to say they're very impressive on this.
Absolutely, and in fact, I noticed that the difference between, you know, their response to cans versus bottles as well, and I thought it was notable that they actually co-founded the Glass Recycling Coalition across the nation. So this really, no matter what they're putting the beer in, they're doing making an effort to make sure that it's you know, recycled on the back end and all, but also, like you said, they have clear eyes about it, right? They're giving a thoughtful, honest response about, well, you know, it can really depend. Maybe the cans can be, have a higher emissions on the back end of the process and bottles are different in this way. And they're not just saying something to, you know,
it's not marketing. It's
right.
Actually thoughtful.
Exactly.
All right.
Right. Right.
Down to brass tacks here. Let's read some beers. 0 to 10. 10's never been done. But, you know.
It doesn't mean it's unattainable.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's unlikely.
And then, you know, add a, you know, up to a point for your sustainability, and we'll go from there. So
yeah.
I will say it's a 7.7 with a 1. So an 8.7. I think it's a... I think it's your like average, very good ale.
And yeah.
Yeah. Nothing special, nothing crazy, but it's really good. Crushability is probably like a 5.5.
Which is, that's a huge compliment.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's, but Mike wants to drink a lot of them and thinks he can't.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I agree. I think it's a fairly straightforward pale ale from a flavor standpoint. We've had a couple others. I actually think the Sierra Nevada is a little bit more flavorful. I can't remember what I gave it. Maybe a flaw in our scoring. But I think this one's, I would say this one's probably for me a 7.5 with a full point for the sustainability, 8.5. And I'm beginning to rethink our sustainability scale. Like, I feel like we should be able to give extra credit for the really high performers, but.
We can make up the rules.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah.
You know what? I'm going to go 7.5, 8.5. Well, I'm going to do that. I'm going to do that. But yeah, they get full points for sustainability. How about you, Ashish?
Yeah, pretty similar. I mean, it's a good, solid beer, good malt, nice and sweet. Nothing special about it, but very easy drinking beer. I would have given it probably a 6 out of 10 plus a point or two if I could for sustainability. So I think our pretty similar score.
Yeah. That's Mike Savage level rating, because he's usually the 6.
Yeah.
Jason, what about you?
I was going to go with a 6 as well, with, you know, 1 or however many points I'm allowed, if more than 1 for the sustainability angle. I wasn't aware of all that they were doing, and that's pretty impressive.
So I got an idea. Since we're all really impressed, why don't we take the average score and give it a collective committee-wide boost for sustainability?
And so our collective score is what? Are we adding 4 or
no? Well, what's the
I got this. So I'm gonna do 6.5 with the full point. So 7.5, which means, just make sure I've got this right. Less this. That's an average of 7.74.
All right. So we can collectively boost their final score as a team. I think we should boost them to an 8.
Yeah.
Seconded.
Absolutely.
You guys good with that?
Yeah.
So let it be known. I mean, if you can start glass recycling and set net zero targets, the green beers guys are going to give you a bonus.
We will scale your test.
Yes.
So this is going to give us, with an 8, it's actually going in our top 10 lists. It goes in at number 10.
That feels good to me.
Yeah. Which I could run down the list if anybody's interested. We got, so we'll go from 10 up. So we have,
okay.
We've got our pale ale here, Fat Tire. Then we've got Allagash White. Then we've got Stone Brewing tied with Ballast Point. Then Dale's Pale Ale, Trillium, Anderson Valley, Urban Chestnut, still hanging on at number 4.
That's from Missouri, you guys.
Sierra Nevada's number 3 with a 9. Then number 2, Maine Beer Company. And number 1, Hudson Valley Brewing with that corn lager. So so it did make the top 10.
The Northwest is woefully underrepresented. I'm going to maybe have to send you some beers.
Please send us suggestions.
No kidding.
Yeah.
I don't know. I call into question the impartiality of this this judging panel
this Boston-based panel.
What was the score of the corn lager? Like, what was the numerical score of that?
That was 9.375.
Yeah, it's very hard to find.
Wow.
It's a corn lager. I still find that incredibly difficult to believe.
It was really good.
Okay. Yeah. Well, thank you, guys.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, with that, this has been Green Beers. Thank you. Till next time.
Thanks, Jason. Thanks, Ashish. Great to talk with you.
Hey, it was a pleasure being here.
Green Beers is brought to you by Renew Energy Partners, your partner in building decarbonization. Decarbonizing your building is good for the earth, and it's a smart business move, but it's complicated, and it can cost you a lot of money. Our goal is to decarbonize your building while saving you money, so all of those retrofits pay for themselves. Learn more at renewep.com.